This is News and Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, a new law will identify HIV-positive patients by name. And playing the political race card, just two of the topics on tap for today. Joining us from our New York bureau, Walter Field, CEO and publisher of the NorthStarNetwork.com, and Pedro Noguera. He's a professor of education at New York University. Also with us, economist and author Julianne Malvo, who's president and CEO of Last Word Productions. She joins us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. I thank you all. Let's start off by taking a look at the situation with the Duke scandal. And we wanted to take a look today at what many people, Julianne Malvo, are suggesting is causing yet another rub in an already complicated situation. And that is what many are calling the outside interlopers, if you will. First and foremost, those accusing Jesse Jackson and others of coming down, agitating the situation. A Durham attorney, Ken Sutton, who represents one of the lacrosse athletes, said it is outsiders who are interjecting race into the story. They've made it a much bigger element than it ever should have been. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but you do hear whispers, not only here, but often, that outsiders are causing problems, Jesse, Al Sharpton, and others. How much credence can you give to this?
Not a drop, Ed. I mean, Dr. Martin Luther King was called an outside interloper with a Birmingham bus boycott. The fact is that injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere. And when you see these two black women who were hired as strippers, these 46, 45 white lacrosse players, you don't need Jesse Jackson to inject race here. It's there. Go to Durham. And you know, there are tensions in parts of North Carolina. There are town-gown tensions, which are also exacerbated by racial economic differences. So you don't need Jesse to do all that. The fact is that we need a rescue mission for the images of African-American women, that Rush Limbaugh can go on the air and call this girl a hoe, that our colleagues in the national media identify this girl as if her stripper was her first, middle, and last name. I mean, she's also a mother and also a student. And one might ask what kind of economic circumstances have led her to have to strip for her tuition. So God bless Jesse Jackson for going in to say that Rainbow Push will pay for her tuition. But nationwide, I mean, didn't we just have someone call our Secretary of State a coon? And the whole Cynthia McKinney situation where people felt compelled to say almost anything they want to about this woman, right or wrong, you do not denigrate black women. And it's the denigration of black women with the very aggressive defense here in attempting to impeach this woman that has brought national leaders there. And as I said, bless them.
Walter Fields, what of the idea of early intervention by national leaders? Jesse Jackson could have made the same statement without going down, allowing others on the ground, if you will, civil rights leaders on the ground to take the first steps here. Does national leadership often come in too early, or is this a good idea?
Well, there's always tension between local leadership and those with a national reputation and some celebrity. I think what people who have, you know, a national profile do is they bring a spotlight to an issue that might otherwise not be shown on a situation. So I don't really have a problem with Reverend Jackson or anybody coming into Durham. You know, I think if you spoke to most students in North Carolina Central, they probably feel like outsiders in their own community. So the notion that there are interlopers that are coming in causing these problems, you know, there's no basis to that. What we have to deal with are the facts on the table, and I think we have to let, you know, the legal process have its due course. But what's clear here is that you have, you know, young black women who unfortunately are put in a position of going to an extreme to try to support themselves. And that's an issue that I think we have to discuss within our own community. You know, why young black women are put in this position, people who want to get an education, who want to do right in life, but have to go to this extreme in order to support themselves. And I think as a community, we need to have a real discussion about that.
Yeah, and anyone who listened in on Tuesday knows that we talked about that ad nauseum during the roundtable. We couldn't even get off of the subject. It was so hot to move on to other topics. Professor, let me ask you, in relation to different prisms, it seems that minorities often want to have, as Walter said, these big names who come in and bring a spotlight to make sure that the nation is watching, so nothing underhanded under the table can go on. Yet the prism that many whites find themselves looking through in these situations is that they feel that the situation is exacerbated by these bigger-than-life figures who come down here and agitate?
Well, I think, again, as a civil rights issue, and I think there are questions related to civil rights of the women involved, that bringing in people like Reverend Jackson, Reverend Sharpton, helps draw attention to the larger political issues. At the same time, it's also important that those who are closest to the issues really have a chance to define and both a strategy and an approach to addressing it. There are a lot of sensitive questions here, and this young woman may not want all of her personal matters aired in public. So the need for some sensitivity, I think, would call for those who are outsiders to really defer to those who are closest to the case, to really take advice from the attorneys involved and from really to try to understand what these women in particular want. We also have to be careful that we don't rush to judgment in either case and not be embarrassed later on by information that no one knew about coming out. So I think that prudence would call for those who want to be involved to tread carefully, lest that they this blow up in their faces.
Julianne Melvo, the professor brings up an interesting point there, because there are whispers of Tawana Brawley here, and that perhaps everyone from the prosecutor to the defense side has moved too quickly in talking about what is.
Well, certainly the prosecutor has said that it's clear to him that a crime was committed and that a rape did take place. It's not clear. Obviously, we cannot conclude that it was the Duke lacrosse players that did it. But it is clear that something has happened here. I agree with Pedro. I do think that obviously there has to be some deliberation. But what you've seen is a very wealthy group of young men surrounded by lawyers. Two young African-American women, one who has been the accuser, with not the same kind of firepower. And so you've seen the media jump on this in ways, and this is our culture. It has nothing to do with race. Our culture now is to try cases in the media and then get around to the courts later. But given that it's going to be tried in the media, I want them to have spokespeople like Jackson and Sharpton and others to speak up. I don't want the Limbaughs of the world to be the ones that are the last word on this.
All right. Let's move our attention to the other side of political growth for minorities, if you will. We have talked about on this roundtable and covered on this program quite extensively the name calling that has hit the press with Michael Steele in the Maryland race, the statewide race there, him being called an Uncle Tom, an Oreo. He, of course, is the Republican candidate for Senate there. What we are now seeing when we take a look in Newark, New Jersey, the race for mayor there, Deputy Mayor Ronald Rice, an ally of former Mayor Sharp James, calling Cory Booker, who is the black candidate on the Democratic side there as well, a proxy for ultra-white, ultra-conservatives who are seeking to privatize schools, talking about voucher issues there. When Mr. Booker in 2002 ran against Sharp James, Sharp James suggested that Booker was a suburbanite who was not, quote, black enough. Walter Fields, this brings up the issue of playing the race card against each other and this question of who's black enough, what is black, who defines black. Is this fair game? Should African-Americans and minorities get caught up in this kind of name calling against each other?
I think it's silly and demeaning, you know, and I think it's all vested in this notion of partisan politics. You know, as a political consultant, I have, you know, served both Republican and Democratic parties and really have moved beyond this notion of partisan labeling. And I think it's really unfortunate that we're at a point in time when individuals think that this is a legitimate campaign ploy. Look, I don't care what side of the aisle you may be on. The fact of the matter is that if you're running for office, you should be able to be judged on those issues and not by some sort of derogatory characterization by your opponent. You know, what we see in Newark is, you know, sad, and I think what we see in Maryland is sad, and I think some Maryland Democrats, black Democrats, are speaking out against it because clearly, you know, you have someone like Mike Steele. You may not agree with his policies, but Mike Steele's a first African-American lieutenant governor in that state's history. And I think for that alone, he deserves at least the respect of being a candidate and being treated as such. So I don't think this gets us any further down the road. When you look at the serious issues our community is confronting, this stuff is just a distraction.
Pedro Noguera, we raised this question some time ago on the roundtable, and as we continue to watch this kind of rhetoric heighten, one has to question whether race trumps politics here.
Well, and I think that that's the problem. We're not hearing the campaign deal substantively with the issues and that are really of central importance to the state and to the welfare of the people of Maryland. And I think that to attack this candidate because he's not black enough really clouds the issues. It makes it seem like a personal and petty contest. And meanwhile, the very important issues facing particularly poor people in Baltimore don't get aired. And to me, if you simply stick to the issues, then you draw the distinctions that are most important. But to engage in this kind of smears, I think, just as Walter said, demeans those who engage in them.
Julianne, does it also allow for white candidates to sit back and see how this is used? You know, the question of the liberal use of the N-word is always debated in our community as to whether it allows whites to feel freer to use that word. I would ask the same here.
Well, I do think that white folks have to be sitting here just chuckling because this is just totally absurd. I mean, it's the same kind of warped logic that let somebody make Clinton be the first black president. I mean, what is it that's black? Do you have to eat a sufficient amount of fried chicken, you know, or like, you know, lick your lips off the ribs without ever pausing? I mean, what is black enough? Or have sex in the back of a car with AstroTurf? And I mean, I reject all of those notions. Michael Steele is a decent candidate. I mean, I disagree with him on a number of things, but the fact is that he has been solid on minority business development, and the Republicans have treated him better than the Democrats have treated Kwesi Mfume, another candidate for Senate in the state of Maryland. So we might want to look at that. Now, there are reasons for that and all of that, but we may want to look at some of this nonsense to say what's really going on here. In Newark, it's even worse. I mean, Sharp James attacked Cory Booker so badly in 2002 that they have a whole documentary about it. What's interesting, and I think Pedro might back me up on this, is the data on school choice suggests that if you poll African-Americans under age 35, they're interested in vouchers because urban schools aren't working for them. So until someone comes up with a reasonable solution on how they should educate their kids in a cost-effective way, anyone who raises these issues is going to get their attention. So attacking them simply because someone says voucher is ridiculous, and it turns young people off who are already not particularly partisan. Young black or whites tend not to vote. They tend to register as independents. So you start attacking people on these personal attacks. And what you do is you lose young voters. And we're asking why we're losing young voters. And that's part of the answer.
Mm-hmm. Can I chime in on that question of the schools? Just that is the, I think, one of the examples of the critical issues that gets ignored. Newark public schools have been bad for a very long time. Would vouchers address the problem? Now, I think that's a big question. There are not enough private schools in Newark to serve the needy children. But the need to debate the issue, to talk about the failure of the schools, to talk about the fact that anyone with options, including many middle-class black families who can avoid them, choose not to send their kids in public schools in Newark is a vital campaign issue. To have that clouded over with an attack on Cory Booker, whether he's black enough, really demeans and undermines the whole race.
All right, let me get to this quickly because we're not even going to be able to, unfortunately, get to our fourth topic. We'll hold that over for tomorrow. Here's an interesting and controversial measure that came out of a New York Times article. Based on the fact that about 70% of black children are born out of wedlock, a New York Times article talking about the state of black men, the perilous state of black men, suggested, and this was a Georgetown University economist, so let me go to you. Julianne first suggested that after incarceration, which far too many black men have to deal with, the stricter enforcement of child support policy is the largest factor in keeping young black men in poverty. When you take a look at a statement like this and all the controversy surrounding men and child support in general, how much can you read the idea that this is fair game, or is this just clouding an already confusing issue?
Well, I think it's clouding an issue from the perspective of what you're looking at is young black men having low incomes, being less engaged in the job market. We've all seen the stats with New York City of 48% of African-American men between 16 and 65 not having any jobs at all. And so being jobless and then having the pressure of child support enforcement certainly is a complicating factor. But the fact is nobody makes you go have children and not support them. And we've got to deal with that as well. I mean, there's this craziness about should men be able to opt out of fatherhood? Yeah, and there's a real easy way to do it. Don't have sex or cover it up.
Walter, that was going to be my point. The idea of all of this might be true, but the reality is chances are that, and while not everyone, there are enough men who are incarcerated truly for what they did. There are enough men who have to take the responsibility for fathering these children. It seems to me that this is an easy way out for some of them.
Well, I think for this population of the formerly incarcerated, there is an issue. And I think we have to be honest about the fact that they come out of institutions with no options at all. In New York State, they can't even be employed in a number of industries because New York State law prohibits them from being employed in certain industries. So you come out. I think the issue becomes how we define support. And what I'd like to see is a program that allows these young black men in particular to become part of their families again, to establish relationships with their children again, because for the most part, they don't have a relationship while they're incarcerated. So I think we have to be real in terms of what we can expect in terms of financial support, but look at the wide range of supports that could be possible in rebuilding family, even if that young man is not going to marry the mother of his child. But let's find a way to reconstruct family before we impose onerous burdens in terms of, you know, payments.
Yet, Pedro, it's a real catch-22 here, because while, as Walter says, you want to give an opportunity for these men to get out, to get on their feet, to get stable, there is a certain responsibility socially and economically that you have to the children that you've made.
Absolutely. And that's why I think the truth lies somewhere in the middle. There has to be a fair process for determining what's adequate amount of financial support that fathers must provide, because they must provide the financial support. At the same time, you can't get blood from a stone. Men who are unemployed or who face few prospects for gainful employment are not going to be able to support their children adequately. So you've got to really look at the employment side of the equation. And so, but yes, moral responsibility for raising one's children has to be right there at the forefront, because all of us know too many examples of young men who do not think about this when they make decisions about who to have sex with.
You know, and there's a dotted line between the story we talked about earlier, the young women stripping for tuition, and this story. When we talk about black men, we've got to talk about the status of black women. And when brothers don't step up, sisters are the ones who carry the burden.
Absolutely.
Right. Walter Field, CEO and publisher of the NorthStarNetwork.com. Pedro Noguera, professor at New York University, and economist and author Julianne Malveaux. I thank you all. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.